Welcome to Sidetrack, AM580's monthly features magazine. I'm your host, Jason Croft. On this month's program, we hear about the grilled cheese Madonna and other strange eBay auctions. We get to the meat of the matter with the News Gazette's reluctant townie Ryan Jackson. And we have a live in-studio performance from musician and cartoonist Dave King, otherwise known as the Duke of Uke. That and more, this time on Sidetrack. On the auction website eBay, people have offered up just about anything and everything for auction, including a woman who discovered her grilled cheese sandwich had an impression of the Madonna on it, and a family who sold off grandfather's ghost. Writer Christopher Seiler has written about several of these unusual auctions in his book, The Grilled Cheese Madonna and 99 of the Weirdest, Wackiest, Most Famous eBay Auctions Ever. It's published by Broadway Books. I talked with him recently and asked him to first explain the grilled cheese Madonna.
It's a great story. It's a woman down in Florida. She cooked what she thought was a normal grilled cheese and appeared out of nowhere to her was the face of the Virgin Mary. The woman truly believed that it was the Virgin Mary on her grilled cheese sandwich. She said it brought her luck gambling, that she credited the sandwich with helping her win over $65,000 gambling. She said it was magically preserved in her cupboard for 6 years. And then she decided she was going to part with it and put it up on eBay.
So how did she get from having this grilled cheese Madonna to wanting to put it on eBay?
You know, I think what she saw was another one of the auctions that's featured in the book. A little bit before, Justin Timberlake's French toast, his half-eaten French toast, sold for some exorbitant amount of money on eBay. And I think she was inspired by that and said, well, if somebody will pay for that, then I'll certainly pay for the Virgin Mary on a grilled cheese sandwich.
And how much did the grilled cheese Madonna go for?
The sandwich went for $28,100. It was viewed by the auction when it was live. It was viewed by about 3 million people around the world. A couple months later, she actually sold the frying pan that she created, the Virgin Mary grilled cheese sandwich, and for another $6,000. So all in all, she made about $34,000 on her creation.
It hit the press pretty hard because it was so unusual.
It was all over the world. And basically, that's how I structured the book, was every auction in that book was at one point or another pretty heavily hit by the press. I mean, some more than others. You know, the grilled cheese sandwich and Larry Starr, the wedding dress guy, the guy who dressed up in his wife's wedding dress, ex-wife's wedding dress, and sold it, the bearded tattoo man. Those are two of the most famous, but everyone in the book was in the news.
Well, what made you want to look into the strange stuff that people put up for auction on eBay?
This is a sort of long story. I used to work at the nonprofit that runs eBay's charity works. So if you put up an item for sale on eBay, you can donate a portion or all of that to one of thousands of charities, and the organization is called Mission Fish. And my ex-boss went through a nasty divorce about a dozen years ago. Her husband moved out to the country and got custody of the dog, and she moved into an apartment. That's why she didn't get the dog. But in their separation agreement was that she got visitation rights, and he couldn't get rid of the dog without asking her first. Well, in the mail one day at work, she got in the mail an urn full of her dog's ashes and a vet bill for $350. So to get back at her ex-husband, she put it up on eBay, you know, telling the story of what a nasty person he was. And we got a lot of hits before it got pulled, so then I went to look to see whether there are other sites dedicated to, you know, the famous auctions to see how 5,000 hits is what, you know, we got compared, and I couldn't find any. That's how the book was born.
Well, you mentioned a couple of things already that made a lot of press being on eBay. The wedding dress guy, and of course the grilled cheese Madonna. Name a couple of other things that have appeared on eBay that have been rather unusual.
Well, in the United States, we had somebody about 8 years ago try and auction off a kidney, saying, you know, he only needed one to live, and tried to make money selling his kidney. Britney Spears' pregnancy test showed up on eBay, the positive pregnancy test. That got pulled. Both of those auctions got pulled. They violate the policy of having something that's got DNA, human DNA, attached to it. But you know, these auctions make the news all over the world. In Great Britain, one of the most famous auctions over there was that there's a shock jock, basically equivalent to Howard Stern in Great Britain, and he insulted his wife one too many times. I guess this is his ex-wife now. He had a prized Lotus automobile, and she was on the title, so she put it up on eBay as a, with a buy it now for 1p. So he lost his Lotus for about 3 cents. He came home, she was gone, the car was gone.
Yeah, well, it seems like people put things on eBay for all sorts of reasons. Of course, you know, for money, that's a big one, but in that case with the shock jock and his ex-wife, definitely revenge is on that one. What other reasons?
That have been revenge. An individual, his wife was cheating on him. This is, again, from Great Britain, and he sold off all, he said he was going to sell off all of her possessions while she was traveling with her her fling, and starting with her underwear. Another individual, again in Great Britain. Great Britain's got, I guess, the revenge ones. This person was invited to a wedding that he didn't really want to go to. He didn't like the bride, so he put up wedding invitations, and that got all over the world. You know, take my two wedding invitations and go to the wedding. Nobody will know it's not you. And then there's a horribly mean story about the bride and how him and none of his friends didn't like the bride. So that's why they weren't going.
Well, tell me about selling off Grandpa's ghost.
This is a story. It was around Christmas time, right around actually the time the Grilled Cheese Madonna came out. A little boy was scared of his grandpa. His grandpa was terminally ill when little boy was remembered him. And when the grandfather passed away, the little boy was convinced that the grandfather's ghost was going to haunt him. And so he was scared of going in rooms and in the house. And his mother finally, you know, said, well, we can auction off the ghost on eBay. And so she sold the cane and said the ghost is going away. And the boy was, you know, relieved, and she didn't think they'd get much attention for it. But, you know, lo and behold, she got over $25,000, I think, for her grandfather's ghost. That was $64,000. $64,000 she got for her grandfather's ghost.
You know, we actually had our own story here regionally that of a strange item that went on eBay. This college kid, not too far away, found a piece of chicken in the dormitory cafeteria that looked like the face of Pope John Paul II. And he sold it on eBay for a few hundred dollars. It seems
The Pope, when the new Pope took over, his used car showed up on eBay Germany. That went for $300,000. Other things that related to the Pope, the past Pope, the Pope blessed communion. And this actually caused a big uproar all over the world. A couple people had taken the communion and auctioned off the Holy Communion on eBay. Catholics all over the world were up in arms about that one.
Well, it seems religious artifacts are huge. You know,
anything that people believe in. You know, the thing is about the grilled cheese sandwich, at least, is that that lady really truly believed that the grilled cheese sandwich, you know, had the face of the Virgin Mary in it. As bizarre as it sounds to a lot of people, she was convinced that the Virgin Mary had shown up on her grilled cheese. Another individual thought that Jesus had shown up on his bathroom wall, and so that's another sale. And he seemed firmly to believe also that that was Jesus on his bathroom wall.
Well, one company, more than anyone else, seems to be grabbing up all these unusual items that appear on eBay. Tell us who they are.
It's GoldenPalaceCasino.com, and they actually use it as an advertising venue. They are the purchaser of the Grilled Cheese Madonna. They've named babies GoldenPalaceCasino.com, both a boy and a girl. We have GoldenPalaceCasino.com Silverman, which is a boy, and then just plain old GoldenPalaceCasino.com. They've advertised on people's pregnant bellies, on foreheads. They actually are the purchasers of the Pope Mobile, the former Pope's car.
Well, they also bought the Pope Chicken here locally.
Really?
Yes, regionally too. They bought the Pope Chicken, so they're everywhere. I guess they've cornered the market on snapping up these strange objects.
Yeah, we actually just ran a charity auction with my book, the first book that was ever printed and signed by some of the people whose stories were included in Golden Palace Casino. Snap that up, too.
Well, how does eBay feel about this? I know that you said that they've actually shut down a few auctions because it violates the agreements for doing auctions. But in general, how do they feel about these unusual items?
You know, I think they've remained decidedly noncommittal on these sales. I think it brings them pretty good publicity, so they're probably fans of them, although, you know, some of them are a little bit out of the ordinary. They pull off, again, you know, anything related to with human DNA, but they've had to shut down people trying to sell their virginity.
Somebody selling their soul?
Somebody selling their soul. That doesn't go over very well on eBay. They've shut down people selling drugs. I have a whole section on criminal acts on eBay, basically, that eBay has had to shut down. People selling drugs, people selling... somebody stole a ballot box when the whole big fiasco between Al Gore and George Bush was unfolding. Somebody stole a ballot box in Broward County, and they were counting the ballots, and this person decided to auction off the ballot box that they had stolen. Well, the whole world was watching and wondering where all the ballots are, appears on eBay, a ballot box. Those people, of course, ended up caught and in jail, but you wonder how our president really got elected.
So, for you, what is the strangest of the strange that has appeared on eBay?
Oh, you know, there's just so many of them. I think that George Best, he was a soccer player in Great Britain. Somebody claimed he was a heavy drinker, and somebody claimed to have retrieved his, when he had a liver operation, claimed to have retrieved the liver from an incinerator in the hospital over there where the operation occurred, and tried to sell that on eBay. That's bizarre. One of my favorite stories, and kind of make is a warning for, you know, you don't never know who you're dealing with on eBay. There was a seemingly normal item. It was a set of band uniforms up for sale on eBay, and a gentleman from New York won. He outbid an individual from Louisiana. For 3 months, the person from Louisiana tried to convince the man from New York to sell him the band uniforms and started calling him nasty names when he wouldn't sell him these prized possessions, I guess. Turns out the guy went up to New York City, located the guy that had bought the uniforms, broke into the apartment with a gun, and the man wasn't there, but tried to force at gunpoint the woman who was in the apartment to give him these uniforms, and that guy is in jail again for, I think he's 3 to 5 years in jail for aggravated assault and attempted robbery. He claimed he dropped the gun, but, you know.
Wow. That's somebody who really wanted band uniforms.
You got to wonder what he was going to do with those uniforms.
So has anything else of note popped up on eBay since this book has been published that you you had included?
Yeah, that'll be edition number 2 for sure. We have, since the book has appeared that aren't in this book, a woman has sold her hand in marriage, or tried to sell her hand in marriage on eBay. eBay pulled that one, but it'll probably be in the book next time. Elvis's first house just sold on eBay recently. Right now on eBay there is a fort for sale, a Civil War fort, on the border of Canada and New York that's for over $5 million. It's probably going to break the record for the most expensive sale ever to occur on eBay. Those are just 3 of the many, many items. And maybe the chicken and the Pope. I'll have to look that one up.
So if people want to find more about your book, The Grilled Cheese Madonna, 99 Other of the Weirdest, Wackiest, Most Famous eBay Auctions Ever, where can they go search it out at?
It should be in bookstores everywhere. It's on Amazon.com, Borders online. I have a website, grilledcheesemadonna.com, where there's links to the book at Amazon. But it should be almost at any bookstore.
All right. Well, Chris Seiler, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
This is Sidetrack. Last fall, staff at the Brookfield Zoo noticed a bird was missing his perch when he tried to land. They sent the double-crested cormorant, a large water bird, to an animal hospital and learned he'd gone blind. But rather than put him to sleep, zookeepers decided to try some unusual techniques to help him fend for himself. Lynette Kalsness has more.
Hi, sweetie. Hello, good guy. How are you today? Good morning. Good morning. How's my boy? Are you a good guy?
Zookeeper Andreas Leibus walks into a zoo exhibit that's called the Swamp. It's humid, and there are birds perched all the way up some tall trees that reach to the skylights. But down on the ground, next to a small pond, there's a bird all by himself. He looks like a skinny, stretched-out goose with a long bill.
You're okay. You're okay. It's just me. It's just me. You're safe. Don't worry, sweetie. You're safe.
Zlabus bends over and rubs the chest of a double-crested cormorant named Oscar. This is her usual greeting for Oscar, now that he's blind.
Well, I always put myself in the animal's position, and I always think I like back rubs, and I like tactile sensations, and to me it's just a comforting gesture. It's just that tactile sensation as one animal to another.
When the zoo first got Oscar from a rehab center 10 years ago, He'd already lost his sight in one eye, but he flew just fine. Then last October, he started crash landing. Doctors figured out infections had taken the sight in his good eye. Staff had to feed him four times a day by hand.
We were having to make the decision if, how far do we go with this? How's his quality of life? You know, we even had to consider euthanasia. And we wanted to avoid that because we felt we owed it to Oscar. He was with us from the beginning of this building, and when you get right down to it, he's blind. It's not as if he couldn't get around otherwise.
Zlabus says first, they decided to see if Oscar could swim. Zlabus went in the pool with him in her wader boots. She deliberately put herself in his path so he would crash into her and learn what to do.
When he swims, he'll use his beak just like a blind person would use their cane to see what obstacles are there so that he can navigate the pool.
Next, the staff needed to see if he could somehow feed himself. They brought out a plastic box full of fish and set it near the bird. Then they splashed the surface of the water and talked to him to let him know that food was near.
Oh boy, guess what? It's food time.
Oscar dunks his head into the water and grabs fish in his serrated beak. He chomps down hard, shakes his head, and the fish goes sliding down his throat.
You can see he's a mess of an eater. He's searching around for his favorite items first, and if he finds one he doesn't care for, it goes flying, so we have to watch it. I'm too close to him. I'm in the firing range. I'm getting soaked here with fish that he's throwing around.
Zlabus says Oscar is a success story for zookeepers. She says Oscar showed them what animals can do.
We do so much with the animals, but we still put our humanisms on them because we don't know what it's like to be an otter. We don't know what it's like to be a cormorant. And it's fascinating when you work with animals because they teach us really how small we are in the bigger picture.
She says Oscar is doing so well now, he's here to stay. I'm Lynette Kulsmas.
Oh boy, that's
You're listening to Sci-Track. H.G. Wells is remembered today for his science fiction, such as War of the Worlds and The Time Machine. In addition, he was one of England's best-known public intellectuals of the first half of the 20th century, producing a constant stream of books, essays, and opinions for a wide audience. But the latest book about H.G. Wells focuses on his creations for a very exclusive and narrow audience, his second wife, Amy Catherine Robbins. It examines the pictures that H.G. Wells drew for his wife. The book is called The Pictoires of H.G. Wells, A Burlesque Diary. It's by Jean Rinkel and Margaret Rinkel and published by the University of Illinois Press. As part of the afternoon magazine, AM580's Jim Meadows spoke with the Rinkels about the book and their process of putting it together.
These pictures, these little sketches and cartoons, first of all, they're in the collection of the University of Illinois. How did we get them?
The H.G. Wells collection was purchased from the family in 1954. A large collection of 70,000 of his letters, letters to H.G. Wells, 3,000 of his letters. There are also all of his manuscripts, including The Time Machine and War of the Worlds, and quite an array of photographs and other archival materials.
These drawings, and they look like very ready cartoon sketches. Did H.G. Wells have any art training or drawing training of his own?
Margaret would.
Yes, he did. He took geometric and freehand drawing. He started drawing actually when he was a small boy, and then as he went to school, he would doodle in his textbooks and so forth. When he became a pre-college student, he started his drawing of sketches for various people, friends and family particularly.
And these sketches, they were, as you said, for friends and families. He never really drew for publication.
No, he didn't. He was asked at various times to do so, but he usually said no. However, there was one one magazine, the Strand magazine, who ran an article on H.G. Wells plus several other people who also wrote and drew pictures. And he did appear in that with a couple of cartoons.
Now, your book, this book that you put together, does it focus specifically on the drawings he made for his wife, Amy?
This is one of the theses that I have argued. It has been long related in general that all of his cartoons were called pictuas, and that's acceptable. But by his own definition, he narrowed those to the ones he did for his second wife, Amy Catherine Robbins.
And Amy Catherine, whom he had, about a 25-year, 30-year relationship?
Close to 30 years.
These show up in letters. They also, some of these seem to be showing up on the head papers of his books.
Yes. Whenever a book came off a publication, he would cite one to his wife, Jane, and he did this particularly for her. He did this for several other people as well, but his wife had many, many presentation copies.
Those presentation copies usually picked up some character or incident in the book and related Jane's role in his writings.
And coming off of that, these drawings, a lot of them are really about them, about H.G. Wells and about Amy. And it's little pictures, little self-caricatures of themselves.
Yes, he said, looking at them, they look like the most random of doodles, but they are really acute statements of personal interpretation. So they are the way to get behind the public image or persona and understand the relationship on a very humorous level between a husband and wife.
In public life, especially as he grew older and more respectable, I get the idea from reading about him that H.G. Wells wanted to be known as a grand man of ideas who really had big ideas about the human condition and about society. But that's not quite the H.G. Wells you see in these little pictures.
No, the H.G. Wells we see in the pictures is a very human person dealing with small scenes of everyday life, gardening, whatever they happened to do at the time. He would make small sketches of various activities that they engaged in, and they were very personal, not for public consumption.
And he ended up, saying that they eventually, unconsciously, became a burlesque diary of their lives.
And you should notice, I'm just looking through some of these drawings in the book, and I keep on seeing the H.G. Wells character, always someone with a sort of prominent nose and a little bushy mustache underneath. And that was how he presented himself in these drawings to his wife.
Yes, it was. And they sat down early on and decided what seemed to pick up their characteristics best. And you'll notice that for Jane, normally there are a lot of gracious curved lines for her. And then he doesn't mind poking fun at his nose or the straggly hair. They tried to personalize it so that they could be sure who was who, and I think they really accomplished it.
H.G. Wells never made drawings like this, or did he, for his first wife?
We have not found any so far, and often many of these sketches, even that he made for his second wife, were thrown away, so we don't know but what he could have made some that were thrown away and never saved for posterity.
And particularly because he threw away much of the correspondence of his first wife as well, and we regretted it later, so there may have been some in that.
You went through, to put this book together, how many drawings, little drawings by H.G. Wells?
Well, about 650 in various scattered places, as you've called attention to some of those. But they are not only from his books and his letters, but on scraps of paper, sometimes on just a full sheet of material, sometimes a lined notebook, sometimes a rather more ambitious drawing that you could tell that he focused on.
Besides their own relationship and how they regarded their relationship, did these drawings touch on anything else going on in their lives?
Very definitely on the womanizing that he did. they did have a modus vivendi in which, equally agreed upon, he could have his facades because she was supposedly a very frail woman, and she would remain Mrs. H.G. Wells, and she would check or okay the women that he happened to have these short facades with.
And that's something to go into. H.G. Wells was not a monogamous man. He had several love affairs, and what you're saying is that Amy Catherine knew of them, and I'm sure she wasn't enthusiastic about them, but she must have given some tacit approval.
She did. It's a very complex relationship, and one that would be hard to explain in less than an hour or so, I expect.
We discussed that a good deal when Margaret and I began to come to terms with this. It was so outside our experience and understanding of such a relationship, but we began to develop some understanding and empathy for that very loyal bond that was between them in spite of this aspect of their lives.
How does that aspect of their lives play out in these drawings?
When he drew, say, his wife dropping a bomb on him for some escapade that she might not be too happy about. In fact, Chapter 5 deals with a number of these areas where Jane may appear as a witch on a broomstick, more or less, or a bombardier or an archer. These items certainly typify what was going on as far as that goes, but I keep thinking that on her death, he was absolutely devastated. He suggested that Jane and two other women, his first wife and one other, were the only persons, the only women he had ever loved in his life.
Now, Amy Catherine, did she ever comment or have anything to say, any record, anything in letters that touches on these drawings?
Only indirectly in her letters, some reactions. There is no analysis of the Pictures, but there is a good deal of indication that she had more to say about his writings.
And that goes up to another level. What role did Amy Catherine play in Wells' writing? Was she a mentor, a cheerleader, someone who gave suggestions or editing criticisms?
I think both. She certainly gave criticisms, and he listened to her. There's one picture in Chapter 6 where he is sitting, looking very meek and humble, and she is looking over the manuscript of Love and Mr. Lewisham. And when she says, "Poor stuff," he is totally devastated for a bit. So, yes, she played a definite role. She helped him in the beginning, gathering ideas. I used to check or go out into London and look for ideas. She would do all the typing. She would correct his grammar. So she played a distinct role in all of his writings.
And I'm looking at the drawing now. Yes, H.G. Wells looks sort of like a child in the principal's office.
Yes, he does.
While and this is one of the more complex drawings of Amy Catherine looking at the manuscript, it's captioned here, "Waiting for the verdict."
Yes, he has moved away from his cartoon style for that particular one.
Amy Catherine Robbins died in 1927, and H.G. Wells was, I guess, in his 60s then. He never remarried, but he was certainly very active and an active writer towards, until just about the end of his life in his 80s. Did he continue to make these pictures for other people?
He had a relationship with Rebecca West, and there is these characters are, they name themselves Bits and Bins.
That's H.G. Wells
and
Amy.
That's H.G. Wells and Amy.
And I should say that Bins is H.G. Wells.
That's correct.
And Bits is Amy.
Bits because of her size, and Bins based on a Cockneyism for husbander, and they dropped the down to from husbander to bender. He became Mr. Bender and then finally just Bins. And so that relationship, there is another pair with Rebecca West where they become Panther and Jaguar. So he did another set of pictures for Rebecca West.
That was Gene Rinkel. He and his wife, Margaret Rinkel, are authors of The Picture Was of H.G. Wells, A Burlesque Diary. It's published by the University of Illinois Press. They spoke with Jim Meadows as part of the Afternoon Magazine. Still to come on the program, a live in-studio performance with Dave King, otherwise known as the Duke of Uke. Stay tuned. You've got attuned to Sidetrack.
If you are what you eat, then I'm a Nero's Giro's pizza puff. A big, flaky, cheesy pizza puff with a side of mozzarella sticks and onion rings.
A meaty commentary from Ryan Jackson, the News Gazette's reluctant townie.
If I was what I ate, I would walk around all day with pools of grease soaking my shirt until it was translucent. I would sweat liquid fat and marinara sauce, and you'd have to use a wet nap after you shook my hand. If I was what I ate, I would be the supersized combo, and you'd want to eat me too. Only you wouldn't be able to, because Jenny Craig would have had me assassinated last week. I don't pay attention to my diet as much as I should. Human beings have evolved into omnivores, but, and this might not come as a shock to some people, I tend to take steps backwards where evolution is concerned. I rock it old school, celebrating my spot at the top of the food chain. Meaning that, unless you count the bun and pickle, I'm pretty much a straight-up carnivore. I love me some meat. Cow meat, pig meat, chicken meat, crab meat, cheeseburger meat, they're all the same to me, which is to say they are all scrumptious. During my travels, I've ran into those inexplicable herbivores called vegetarians. Their way of life is entirely foreign to me. I cannot comprehend an existence without a meat-heavy diet. What's the use of breathing if you spend all of your hours without the mouth-watering glory of a Chicago-style hot dog, or the warm, comforting therapy of a sausage biscuit? How could you have the strength to carry on, to face the day? Meat is the wind beneath my chicken wings. Some vegetarians don't eat meat because they cannot stand the taste. They're obviously liars, since meat is so succulent and tender. Their explanation is, however, easier for me to swallow than the alternative. Other, more militant factions of vegetarians refuse to eat meat because of how animals are treated in meat processing plants. But, ironically, most of them also seem to own some leather hippie sandals. It's not the Wild West anymore, people. The majority of Americans don't possess the skills, equipment, or stomach to catch their own food, kill it, clean it, and cook it. We have syndicates of food vendors to take care of the dirty business for us. But make no mistake, by the corporate world's big, uncaring hand, or by our own, that bag of beef jerky will have to die before it can be consumed. You can dress the factory like a Holiday Inn, sing the livestock lullabies, or bake them sugar cookies, but the only way those animals are exiting the building is through the use of a meat grinder. It is their fate. It is their destiny. And who are you to argue with fate, nor destiny? And how ethically responsible are consumers for crimes committed against poultry, cattle, and swine, given the limited number of ways they have of procuring meat otherwise? Vegetarian or not, would you really be cool with your neighbor's chicken coop jutting into the middle of your driveway? So ask me if torturing an animal is a bad thing, and I'll say yes. Of course it is. It's an evil thing. Don't get me wrong, I'm not the type of guy who kicks puppies and swings cats around in wet burlap sacks. But if you were to ask me if I was evil because, by some degrees of separation, the chickens that became my bucket of KFC were tortured and murdered by an assembly of machines, well, I might have to think about that for a minute. Can an assembly of machines, which are by definition soulless entities, truly be evil? And what kind of fulfilling life does a chicken have to look forward to, really? I mean, it may have crossed the road, but now what? The Nobel Peace Prize? Volunteering with Habitat for Humanity? What kind of difference is any one chicken going to make for the larger chicken kind? And what difference are you really going to make by emancipating the imprisoned tank of crustaceans at Red Lobster? besides leaving a bunch of rich folks and gold-digging first dates hungry. I'm going to end this diatribe by telling you exactly what you're missing out on. Just maybe, you'll give Meade another chance. You have not lived properly until you visited Scully's Chicken and Fish, located on the corner of Washington and Cottage Grove in Urbana. Their chicken wings are plump, hefty, and beyond delicious. The Scully's secret sauce is addictive as anything I've ever encountered. I'm talking about a waking up in cold sweats level of deliciousness. IHOP's pigs in a blanket, sausage links wrapped up in pancakes sprinkled with powdered sugar, are an absolute must. Also, there is no greater burger in Champaign-Urbana than the double cheeseburger at Todd and John's. Super huge and tasty with your choice of cheese. Mmm. I had my first one last week and the after effect was narcotic. When you go there, though, make sure to pop that extra $1.50 for the ballpark-style fries. Well, unless you're sickened by the way, for centuries, mankind has callously skinned, boiled, diced, sliced, fried, scalloped, and mashed its way through Mother Earth's innocent potato population.
The comments of Ryan Jackson, who writes the Reluctant Townie column for the News Gazette. His column appears in print regularly on Fridays. This is Sidetrack. Music from local musician and ukulele player Dave King, otherwise known as the Duke of Uke. He has recently released his debut album called The Duke of Uke. He stopped by the WILL studios last week to play a few tunes and to talk about the ukulele and his upcoming children's album. We'll get to the interview in a moment, but first, a song. This is Guru, The Duke of Uke, live from the WILL studios here on Sidetrack.
Super glue, let me be a Cuban yummy glue, let me do the things gurus do, baby. Let me be a part in your folklore, let me be a fly in your screen door, let me bag your cruises at the store, baby. Well, let me be your guru, let me be your JC, let me be your Buddha too now.
That is the song Guru from the Duke.
Genius.
The Duke of Uke, otherwise known as Dave King.
Yeah.
So
it was a great song.
That was a great song. There are not a lot of ukulele players out there. How did you get hooked into the ukulele music?
Well, it's interesting. There actually are a heck of a lot of ukulele players out there, and I did not know that when I got the ukulele. Urbana's got a long history of actually having very good ukulele players. We had Willy Waugh for a while, and we had the Viper for a while. And I remember thinking that was neat to live in a town that had two prominent and brilliant ukuleleists. That was years before I ever picked up a ukulele. I used to play guitar. And then what happened was one day I was going by a pawn shop, and I had a Game Boy that I had that was just sucking the life out of me. And I was getting kind of burnt out on this Game Boy. And I'm a grown man. I shouldn't really have one anyway. And I walked in, and I noticed that they had this little ukulele on the wall. I thought, oh, yeah, you know, I've seen them around, and I've always liked the sound of them. So I asked them how much they would buy the Game Boy for, and he said $20. And I said, how much is that uke for? And he said $20. And I was like, well, it's clearly meant to be. So I took it back with me that very day, and it just immediately fell in love with it. But I hadn't heard much ukulele music, so where I'm kind of coming from is like funk music or rock music or whatever, and so I just started doing that on the ukulele, and just took right to it. Yeah.
Well, explain or give us a visual of your ukulele there, because it's very different from the standard type.
Well, it looks like Liberace's ukulele. What I did was the first thing I did was there was a special, you know, the Ken Burns series on jazz. And a quote from that series that resonated with me was a musician once said, all you need to survive on the road is your horn and a picture of Louis Armstrong. And I love Louis Armstrong. So I put the first thing I did was I put Louis Armstrong's picture inside. And then I bejeweled it and begolded it with puffy paint and fake jewels from Hobby Lobby. just to make it look, I just wanted it to look kind of Baroque and antique, because it looked a little boring before. Yeah.
Is there a trick to playing the ukulele? Is it really as sort of basic as it looks?
It's like, you know, it's like chess or something, where, you know, it doesn't take long to learn the basic rules of it, but then you know, you can be learning on it forever. There's always something to learn on it, you know. It is, I think, relatively easier than the guitar, because it's only four strings, so like a lot of the chords that are on guitar are just, you know, you just hold one string down on the ukulele, so it's a little bit more, it's a bit easier to get right into. But then technique, it's, you know, there really isn't that much of a difference. You know, it's still a stringed instrument. You still have to learn scales and fingering and things like that. So in a way, it's easier, and in a way, it's exactly the same as any other stringed instrument. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, do you want to play another song for us?
Sure, yeah. This is one called Be My Love, and this is a song that I wrote for my friends Ben and Sarah for their wedding.
Okay, it's the Duke of Uke.
Woohoo!
Right here on Sidetrack.
Well, now
for you like an apple on a tree. Well, I tried every time, but her body's a track. There's no escaping your gravity, yeah, yeah.
Right here on Sidetrack with the tune Be My Love.
Aww.
You know, you are probably the most soulful ukulele singer I have ever heard.
Thank you.
Because usually they don't, usually hear that. You usually hear sort of the Hawaiian hapahala or in the Viper's case, the yodeling.
Yeah. I was a bit surprised when I got into ukulele music, I didn't really know that there were many out there at all. And then I discovered a whole bunch of them online, actually. But I found that most of them are doing one or two things. They're doing kind of funny songs, or they're doing old covers. And so I think that what I wanted to do with it, well, not what I wanted to do with it, what I've been doing with it, is, you know, I wanted to do something a bit, you know, funkier and more soulful than most of those people are doing. I think what it comes down to is that a lot of people think of the ukulele as kind of a joke instrument, like a funny instrument. But I think it's a very versatile, lovely instrument, you know. So I kind of wanted to bring that out about, you know.
Well, you do have an album out, mm-hmm. a CD, which actually is more than just you and the ukulele. There's a little bit more to that album.
Oh yeah, it's got. With it, I wanted to show the versatility of the ukulele, and so there's, like, you know, there's funk beats, there's a whole different kinds of styles, a lot of sound effects, and a lot of foo-fa-ra. Yeah, but I wanted to show the ukulele as a rock instrument, and as a soul instrument, and as a ballad instrument. You know.
Well, some of the stuff on your album is rather psychedelic,
which
is a strange genre for the ukulele. I guess maybe not with Tiny Tim and his, you know, his impact on ukulele music.
Yeah. Tiny Tim was pretty far out. That's my favorite thing about Tiny Tim is reading these interviews with these just completely weird hippies, and even they in the 60s were like, that guy is far out. Like, they couldn't handle Tiny Tim. Like, no, he was just so far out. Yeah. I don't know. I grew up, you know, listening to psychedelic music. I mean, the earliest music I remember hearing is Sgt. Pepper and things like that. And I just considered it imaginative music, kind of, in a way. So thank you for bringing that up. Psychedelic uke.
Well, you are working on another project, which is kind of in a way that touches on that psychedelic mood in a bit, and that fantastical
does.
And that's children's songs.
You're absolutely right. In fact, you can get way farther out with kids songs than you can with normal songs, you know. But I've just been I've been making these weird puppets. I just started making weird puppets. And I've also I'm on MySpace, and I buy into the myth of MySpace, and that like if I get befriended by a bunny or you know, some kind of stuffed monkey, I believe that I'm actually communicating with a monkey. I'm like, woo, you know, I've got a friend. I'm a friend with a monkey. I get very excited, and I have no concept of reality. So I started making puppets because I'm very charmed by them. And then from that came the idea of like, you know, wouldn't it be great if there was a kid's show that was genuinely funny and where the music was good as opposed to like Barney. I don't mean to knock Barney. I think they run him here, don't they? Okay. I can't knock Barney. We're going to have to cut this out. But I'd say that a lot of the music in children's shows and albums, I don't think is as good as it could be. Or I just wanted to make really rocking, great children's music. So,
and you're going to play one for us right now.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. I don't know if there are any dinosaurs out there listening, but this goes out to you folks.
It's the Duke of Uke. Otherwise known as Dave King and his ukulele, right here on Sidetrack.
This goes out to all you dinosaurs in Radioland.
Favorite dinosaur, some ukulele music for children, courtesy of the Duke of Uke, who is live here in the studios on Sidetrack.
Barely live.
The Duke of Uke, otherwise known as Dave King.
Akka.
So you are also known in this town as, beyond the Duke of Uke, you are a longtime cartoonist.
Yeah, you
did the Bob and Dave cartoon, which still appears now and again. And you do other one-panel stuff that appears now and again.
Yeah, now I'm doing Dave's Dream Diary for The Hub. which is it's just a good gig because the hardest part about writing cartoons is actually coming up with the jokes. And the dream diaries are literally just things that I find in my dream diaries. And so it's all free material. I don't have to do anything. I just have to illustrate them. And I've been blessed with a absurd dream life. So
so how does this all tie in to the songs you write? And, I mean, the ukulele seems, you know, in its in and of itself seems like a an instrument out of someone's dreams, and because it's unusual. And
yeah, I don't know where it all ties in together. I'm thinking maybe someday it will all dovetail into something. I don't know. I don't know how they all connect. Yeah. I just like to keep busy.
So the children's music, that's going to be on a CD soon?
Hopefully, yeah, yeah. And we're making film right now. We're filming these puppets doing absurd and ridiculous things. And those will hopefully go online fairly soon. And the children's CD may be a while. I'm just getting a demo together right now. So I'm going to pitch it to places that produce children's music and see if one of those guys picks me up. So if you're listening right now and you're waiting for the next big thing in children's ukulele music, call.
So if people want to listen to your other ukulele music, the Duke of Uke,
oh, yeah,
the first album, where can they get that and where can they hear more about you at?
Okay, well, the Duke of Uke album is available at Parasol. That's online as well, parasol.com. And you can hear more about my exciting life and adventures at myspace.com/Duke of Uke. And you can learn more about the children's stuff and the puppets and all that tomfoolery at myspace.com/lullapop, like lullaby plus lollipop, lullapop.
And you do go out and you play live for people as well around the region.
Yeah, yeah.
Dave King, a.k.a. the Duke of Uke.
Akka.
Thanks.
Thank you, man.
Thanks for coming in. And
hey, thanks for having me. And it's been nice to be in the air conditioning because it is really hot outside.
The Duke of Uke here live on Sidetrack. Well, that does it for another edition of Sidetrack. Jay Pierce is our senior editor, and I'm your executive producer and host, Jason Croft. This episode, as well as all the past episodes of Sidetrack, are available in real audio on our website, and you can subscribe to our podcast as well. Just go to WILL.UIUC.EDU, click Listen, and then select Sidetrack. Sidetrack is a production of AM 580, WILL, Urbana.